Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Is it just me, or is Mother Nature mad at us? And getting madder? Does she sometimes seem like a dog trying to shake off fleas? We humans, of course, being the fleas. Does it seem like she tries to send us warnings, and then, when we ignore her like we always do, she's like, okay, I guess you asked for it. Is there anything we can do, stranger, to calm her rage and save ourselves? Or are we just a few short moves away from a big old checkmate? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I love a nice rainstorm once in a while, which is a good thing because Rhode Island, it seems, is becoming more and more like Seattle, weather-wise. There's nothing like a rainy Sunday afternoon nap, or that feeling just when the sky breaks open after a long day of hot, heavy humidity. But I'm also acutely aware of how quickly, geez, we seem to be getting an awful lot of rain these days, can turn into, leave the photo albums, we have to get to higher ground. And every time I see a house in the Hollywood Hills propped up on stilts, or one of those bluffside mansions in Malibu, I think, wow, someone has an awful lot of trust in the gods. Not me. Not today, Bob. I've seen enough disaster movies and actual real-life footage to know there isn't enough concrete or sandbags to keep those structures from getting shaken or stirred right off this earth. And I don't know if those who refuse to acknowledge that are brave or just stupid. These days, if you're awake and have at least half a brain cell still functioning, it's clear to see that the weather everywhere is changing. Not just changing, but getting worse. A lot worse. I'm no meteorologist, but I do know that there have been record temperatures, storms, and flooding all over the planet, and it's only going to get scarier. This may come as a surprise to you, but Mother Nature was never all that nice to start with. She was always a widowmaker, a crowd killer, a capricious force that took who she wanted and made ghosts out of the weak, the strong, the prepared, the stupid, and the unlucky. Point in fact, September 8th, 1900. That day, the little island of Galveston, Texas was busy baking in the early fall sun, minding its own business, when the wind started to blow a bit. Galveston, a small barrier reef-type island, was not some big landmass that Mother Nature decided to flaunt her anger at. Mother Nature doesn't discriminate, after all. Galveston is just over 26 miles long and 2 miles wide. It's bordered on one side by the Gulf of Mexico and on the other by the Galveston Bay, a large inland bay. The city's history is mighty colorful, as many a small seaside town can be. Picture a less Caribbean version of the Pirates of the Caribbean ride at Disney, complete with pirates and, I imagine, its fair share of yo-ho-hoing. The atmosphere on the island attracted one Jean Lafitte, a French pirate who wandered all over the Gulf of Mexico, romancing wenches, drinking rum, and smuggling goods out of and into New Orleans before doing America a solid turn by helping out Andrew Jackson during the War of 1812, and receiving a pardon for his pirating ways in exchange. Lafitte moved to Galveston at the behest of the U.S. government in the hopes that he might be able to wrest it and the rest of Texas away from Mexico and Spanish rule. Never one to miss an opportunity, Lafitte is said to have built a colony of sorts while in Galveston, racking up millions while doing his pirate stuff and ostensibly spying every now and again. He was said to have buried some gold and various booty in the sand there before he supposedly left to rescue Napoleon from Elba. Not British heartthrob Idris Elba, of course. But that's another story. For the longest time, you could still see his little hideaway camp on Water Street in Galveston. It was sort of a low-slung, shell-encrusted hut that in its day was painted red and surrounded by a moat, la-di-da. It looked like it wouldn't last through a good thunderstorm, but stood through a lot worse, because old-school pirates were pretty badass, actually. Anyway. Galveston, which is nearby to the mainland of Texas, was a perfect spot for growth because of its whole port situation. Goods coming in from points elsewhere were then railroaded out of there to points north and west. With the booming cotton economy of the South in the 19th century, the city became known as the Wall Street of the Southwest. Journalist Gary Cartwright, in his definitive history of the island, Galveston, wrote that at the turn of the century, quote, it was the largest, bawdiest, and most important city between New Orleans and San Francisco, end quote. I would be remiss if I didn't remind you that the South, up until the Civil War, thrived because of its cotton-based slave labor economy. But as good as things were going financially, the people of Galveston were about to learn that Mother Nature don't give a fuck how deep your pockets are. Unless you use that money to put up flood walls or build levees or, you know, set up some kind of communication system with a country that can help you detect storms before they're upon you, your money isn't going to save you.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's. Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Things were going great on the Floating G, if you were white, though the wharf bosses there tended to charge excessive fees to offload the cotton and store it in their warehouses before shipping it to locations north. That pissed off the people just up the road in Houston who were also good capitalists and wanted a piece of the pie. They were busy making plans to build their own ship canal so they could bypass the greedy wharf guys in Galveston. Once oil struck a few years later, just east of Galveston at a place called Spindletop, Houston became the energy capital of the 20th century and grew up to be the country's fourth largest city. If it weren't for the greedy Galvestonians, that little city might have been the recipient of all that oil largesse. But no. Not that money would have necessarily saved them from what was quickly blowing their way that September day in 1900. Not only did Galveston have that barrier island problem, at its highest point, the island was only 8.7 feet above sea level, it also had a geography problem. It was in the path of these occasional weather phenomena we like to call hurricanes. On September 8, 1900, the wind started to kick up, bringing high waves playfully crashing into some of the beach town's more touristy attractions, like an illegal gambling parlor and shell shops and bathhouses set on piers that reached out over the water. A very small handful of people on the island thought they had a pretty good handle on how weather worked. Isaac Klein, especially, as he was the chief meteorologist there, working very hard for the U.S. Weather Bureau, now known as the National Weather Service. Klein could and did record all kinds of data, barometric pressure and wind speeds and rainfall amounts, but communication was hobbled between stations throughout the country as well as from places outside the country. It was hobbled, in part, by arrogance and bullshit. Klein, for example, had developed a cockamamie theory that Galveston, because of its shape or something, was immune to seriously terrible weather. I'm sure he had what he thought was good evidence for this, but, you know, some people also think they have good evidence that the Earth is flat, so. In 1891, the editors of the Galveston News asked Klein to do a little fortune-telling. He wrote, quote, "The opinion held by some who are unacquainted with the actual conditions of things, that Galveston will at some time be seriously damaged by some disturbance, is simply an absurd delusion." End quote. I'm sorry, what? Again, I'm no meteorologist, and I'll admit that, like Ruth on Ozark, I don't know shit about fuck, but what? It seems to me that the absurd delusion would be that anywhere on this planet might be immune to serious damage from the weather. Like Galveston was special. Still, one has to give him a modicum of a benefit of the doubt here, because he was also somewhat handicapped in his weather predictions, because Willis Moore, the chief of the U.S. Weather Bureau, had, just a month earlier, decided to ban all telegraphic communication about weather conditions in Cuba. According to a piece from 2023 for the History Channel website, Professor Emeritus at MIT Carrie Emanuel said Moore, quote, "was so jealous of the Cubans that he shut off the flow of data from Cuba to the U.S., end quote. I have no idea why someone would be jealous of an entire country, and so much so that he would ignore their extensive and time-tested studies and information on hurricanes. Talk about hubris. The weather experts in Cuba knew more about hurricanes than anyone else alive. They literally pioneered that shit. They had to. They were being hit left and right on a regular basis by hurricanes. They knew stuff. Moore didn't want to hear it. So he called a halt to receiving any and all Cuban weather info, and likewise didn't want to hear anything out of the folks in the West Indies about storms and wind and impending doom. I guess he was jealous of them, too? This was an order that took effect August 24th, 1900, just 2 weeks before all hell broke loose from the skies onto Galveston. We didn't need those Cubans telling us about the weather because we knew better. I would make a comment about tempting fate or pissing off the gods or about how hubris should have been one of those seven deadly sins, but what happened next kind of does it for me. On the morning of September 8, 1900, after a small but hungry storm had slammed the West Indies and Cuba days earlier, and ships had battled high winds and high seas, and Cuban meteorologists had recognized the power the storm was gaining as it entered the Gulf of Mexico, Galveston remained stupidly and purposely uninformed about what was coming. As far as Galvestonians were concerned, the wind was a nice change from all that heat. Klein lived just 3 blocks north of the Gulf with his family, a pregnant wife and 3 girls, and was a meticulous and vigilant weather scientist who noticed every change in every indicator, but still wasn't all that worried, probably because he thought Galveston was somehow magically immune to bad weather. Later, Buford T. Morris, a part-time resident of the city, would comment that the sky was, quote, "gloriously pink, yet containing a fish scale effect which reflected all the colors of the rainbow. Never had I seen such a beautiful sky," end quote. Now, I don't know if you've ever stood on a beach watching a hurricane about to come in, but I have a girlfriend who has. She says it's honestly the most awe-inspiring thing she has ever beheld. Short of, you know, the birth of her child. The sky she saw was an angry color of indigo, and she said you feel nature is about to show off everything it has chosen to keep in check for years. The wind is in your face, and you can barely stand against it. The ocean is already taking commands from something out there, and it, and you, will bow down to it, or you will perish. Its wrath you can almost touch. I believe her, because, you know, she's the kind who likes nature you can drive to. Not brave, though capable of a great deal of awe. She is not likely to stand on a beach and revel unless it's, you know, worth it. So this was the morning sky that Buford T. rhapsodized about. A sky about to lose its allure to something that is appallingly savage. It came from Africa. It didn't have a name because nobody was that prosaic about weather back in the day. It swung into the Caribbean and then across Cuba, not yet at its most vengeful strength, but gaining in bad attitude every day. And of course, Cuba couldn't let anyone up north in the U.S. know because, you know, of important things like jealousy. And so, the forecast for Galveston that day was rain, with high northerly winds. Sunday's forecast was more rain, followed by clearing. That morning, the ocean drew a crowd, despite the intermittent rain and stiff breezes coming in off the Gulf. Soon enough, the waves were bringing in a lot of pounding water that began to break down the cheap little souvenir stands that dotted the beach. By noon, the streetcars had stopped running as their tracks were underwater, something they were apparently used to as overflows were common when the water got high and frisky. Strangers, I don't know about you, but I think this would be the time to pack up the car and the kids and the dog and my imaginary cat and get the fuck out of Dodge. Of course, they did not have cars, or at least reliable ones, back in 1900, and anyway, by then, it was probably too late. Still ignorant of the wrath about to rain down on them, though, parents let their kids run down to the beach to play. Could you imagine that today? These days, people call CPS if kids are playing outside unattended by an adult. Could you imagine just sending your kid down to the beach during a storm? Not today, Bob. Not in this economy. A few mothers did haul their kids home, thinking they just needed to know where they were should the weather turn worse. As author Eric Larson wrote in his book Isaac's Storm, quote, "Women seemed to understand that something exceptional was occurring, but the men of Galveston went to great lengths to deny the strange feel of the day," end quote. I had a friend once describe a hypothetical in which a man and a woman are walking down the street, and the woman is like, "There's a giant hole about a mile ahead," and the dude is like, "Whatever, that's a whole mile ahead." And then she's like, "Okay, now the hole is half a mile ahead. We should probably come up with a plan." And the dude is like, "It's a whole half mile away. Chillax, baby." And then it's a quarter mile, and then a few hundred yards, and then it's right there in front of them, and the man is freaking out, like, "Oh my God, there is a giant hole here. What are we going to do?" But the woman isn't there anymore because she already doubled back and found a detour. Anyway. The water was rising in the streets, and businessmen lunched, as usual, at Ritter's Cafe, explained Larson, which boasted white-jacketed waiters and sumptuous seafood freshly caught. Or, in the case of that afternoon, seafood just washed up onto their plates. A dozen patrons plus a full staff were inside when the wind tore the building's roof, temporarily bowing the structure's walls, which loosened the ceiling beams, causing the whole building to collapse into itself. Things were getting real, real fast. The dining room on the bottom floor took the brunt of everything that fell into it. The bottom floor was flattened because heavy printing presses were housed on the second floor, which, I'm gonna say, was, on its face, a really bad idea. And then, strange things began lining up one by one for a disaster of epic proportions. But back to the Ritter Cafe, where Larson reports that a waiter was sent to find help for those who had survived the collapse. He drowned on the way. Then, the frogs showed up. They were tiny little frogs, but they were, all of a sudden, everywhere, like rain. Children were delighted. Their parents, all well-versed in biblical lore, were less so. I have failed, stranger, in finding out where those frogs came from. I have Googled my ass off, and the closest I could come was when the Chicago Tribune noted in 2018 that sometimes things like that happen when a whole crowd of stuff, like birds or frogs, are picked up by a tornadic waterspout and deposited as rain elsewhere. Also, I've seen Sharknadoes 1 through 5, so I think I know a little something about animals falling from the sky. Incidentally, a rain of tiny frogs dropped on Hungary twice in 2010. Now's about the time people began to look for shelter in whatever they felt was the strongest house on the block, or they waded downtown to the even more structurally sound buildings on the Strand, a particularly prosperous street of merchants. Okay, so everyone was battening down the hatches, closing shutters, elevating downstairs furniture, filling jars with drinking water, and keeping matches and candles dry. Imagine doing all your storm prep in the middle of a storm because the powers that be decided weather research or warning systems just wasn't an important thing to fund. Incidentally, according to the Los Angeles Times, quote, Project 2025 calls for demolition of NOAA and National Weather Service. Project 2025 calls for the elimination of some of the nation's most dependable resources for tracking weather, combating climate change, and protecting the public from environmental hazards. End quote. Do with that what you will, but don't DM me. I'm just reporting the facts.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
The water continued to rise. Like I said, the island was only 8.7 feet above sea level. The ocean was overtaking the island. It would peak at almost 15 feet above sea level that night, which, depending on where you were, meant you were at the very least 4 feet under. At most, a good 15 or more. In a particularly poignant passage, Larson wrote of that moment, quote, "Suddenly, the prospect of watching their children die became very real. Whom did you save? Did you seek to save one child or try to save them all at the risk of ultimately saving none? Did you save a daughter or a son, the youngest or your firstborn? Did you save the sun-kissed child who gave you delight every morning, or the benighted adolescent who made your day a torment? Save him, because every piece of you screamed to save the sweet one. And if you saved none, what then? How did you go on?" End quote. And this, stranger, is why one should never have more than one child at the absolute max. The wind grew stronger. It would later be determined that the wind had blown a steady 150 miles per hour throughout the night, with gusts up to 200 miles per hour. Houses shook, windows broke, and whole floors of houses sank underwater. As these and other structures fell apart, timber and furniture, animals and fences, railway tracks, and the belongings of tens of thousands of now desperate people filled the streets or flew through the air like spears. Many were killed as slate from roofs sliced through the air and decapitated those trying to save themselves below. Houses left their foundations and fell apart. People were thrown out of windows into the teeming waters that rushed from one end of the island to the other, where the only light visible was the occasional glimpse of the full moon. Almost all of Galveston's children clung to parents who struggled to stay afloat, hit constantly by debris from the surface and below it, pelted as they were by rain that felt like bullets from above. Those outside couldn't hear anything because of the howling wind, and had no idea what fresh hell was up ahead as they floated in the ruins of their homes, some adrift on the ocean, headed forever out to sea. What no one knew or could imagine, really, was that a wall of debris was building due to the constant wind and waves, eventually reaching 3 miles long and 30 feet tall. This monstrous thing moved with the water and acted like a giant scraper, sucking everything it met into its fiefdom, held together by railway track, random furniture, innumerable bodies, and thick, rotting muck, to be found later stuck in the middle of the island. At St. Mary's Orphanage, the 10 Catholic sisters were alone with 93 children who had already lost their parents and likely whatever faith they ever had had. The Mother Superior was just 31 years old and hardly experienced in life-saving or child-rearing. She ordered that the children be lashed together at the waist, creating little chains of up to 9 children roped to a single nun. The oldest 3 children were left unchained to brave the conditions as best they could. And if you think that was a fantastically bad idea, you would be right. According to yesterdaysamerica.com, quote, singing hymns like the Queen of the Waves to distract the children from the tumult outside, the nuns tethered themselves to the children with a small rope around their waists. Sister Catherine held 2 of the smallest children in her arms, promising not to let go. As they finished tying the knots, the winds dashed the boys' dormitory to pieces, sending debris battering against the orphans' shelter. The impact collapsed the girls' dormitory building and forcefully sucked the sisters and children into the surging water. End quote. All through Galveston, it was everyone for themselves. Everywhere bodies filled the waters, landmarks like buildings or monuments or churches were gone. The aftermath, they knew, would be as harrowing as the night. Heroes emerged, of course. People opened their homes to strangers who died with them. The lighthouse keeper on nearby Bolivar Island took in 50 people, including a handful that had abandoned a full train that they'd been using as a storm shelter. They all survived. The 85, who'd bet the train would be a safer choice, did not. The hurricane blew into Houston, too, as what we now call a Category 4 hurricane. It turned east and north and gained some strength as it plowed through the Midwest and turned to pummel New England, then exited back to the sea somewhere on the Canadian coast. 15 died in Ohio, 2 in Illinois, 2 in New York, 1 in Massachusetts, and another in Missouri. The entire U.S. damage exceeded $34 million, or more than $1.2 billion in today money. In Canada, the number of dead ranged from 52 to 232, depending on which source you read, because a lot of ships sunk off Newfoundland as the storm was taking its final bow. Galveston Weather Bureau Chief Isaac Klein later wrote a complete report to his superiors in Washington, D.C., trying hard to frame the devastation that day in professional terms. Quote, "Among the lost was my wife, who never rose above the water after the wreck of the building." End quote. His eldest daughter also did not survive. Sunday morning dawned clear and bright, cool even. There was a breeze. You could smell the ocean. You could smell the rot as well. The very beginnings of decomposition of at least 6,000 people who were left when the water receded, but the muck remained. 6,000. Though some estimates would say the number dead was more like 8,000. Either way, that's more than 15% of the population at the time. But no one could really know. It is known that some 2,000 people who lived there and had survived left the minute they could. And the death toll could have been much worse, except that many families were off the island vacationing when the storm hit. And to be honest, I don't know if that final tally includes all the survivors of the storm who died shortly afterward in the typhoid epidemic that followed the storm. 7,000 buildings, including 3,636 homes, had been destroyed. Two-thirds of the island was in ruins. When help came from across the mainland the next day, no one could believe what they saw. Philip Gordy Tipp, one of the men who made the journey there on a small sailboat from the mainland, remembered, quote, "We kept running into so many dead bodies that I had to go forward with a pike and shove the dead out of the way. There was never such a sight. Men, women, children, babies, all floating along with the tide. Hundreds of bodies going bump, bump, hitting the boat," end quote. People who died were gathered up, sent out on barges to be dumped in the ocean, only for the ocean to return them to the beach the following day. Then they were burned in pyres set along the beach as men worked in 30-minute shifts, drunk, mostly to dull the pain and cover the stench, to shovel the dead into the overworked blazes that remained lit for days. It remains the deadliest natural disaster in American history. So is it any wonder that those who perished in it still haunt the island to this day? Informally, Galveston has been described as a beach attached to a cemetery. It stands to reason that a place that experienced such fierce devastation overnight would have its fair share of spirits kicking around on its beaches, in its homes, on its hallowed medical school facade, wandering its cemeteries, and its Walmart. That's right, Galveston has a haunted Walmart. Though, if you ask me, every Walmart is pretty haunting. The Walmart, the only one on the island, of course, wasn't there when the disaster struck, but it's there today, on the West End, just past 61st Street. It was built on the land where St. Mary's Orphanage once stood, and where almost everyone in it was swept away by the tide. Anyone who walked the beach after the storm knew that no one had survived within its walls, though plenty had hoped that the nuns had managed to abscond with the children to higher ground and simply had not come out to show themselves yet. But when a rescuer found a small child's body on the beach near the collapsed orphanage and attempted to pull it free, another child's body appeared, rope at the waist, bound to the first body. Then another, and another, until he dug up 8 children and a nun. The only orphans to survive the storm were the 3 older ones who hadn't been tethered to the others, and saved themselves by climbing a tree and riding out the storm. The nuns had not considered that their heavy habits would be like anchors when wet, disallowing any real attempt at buoyancy when the waters overtook them. The children, bound to the fate of the nuns, had no chance at all. The rescuers continued to claw at the same mound of debris until all the children and the nuns entrusted with their care were unearthed. They are all said to be properly buried near where they lay. The Walmart was built a full century later upon their graves, perhaps explaining why there is laughter in the store when there are only security cameras to hear them, and why the toy aisle simply does not stay properly stocked on many nights. I dare say those children deserve some happiness, somewhere, sometime. Lord knows no one else in a Walmart ever seems too happy. But ghost children aren't just relegated to the Walmart. Some report hearing and seeing them over at the historic Galvez Hotel as well. The Old City Cemetery, too, is the site of frequent paranormal reports. The night of the storm, the soggy earth spilled its inhabitants out of their graves and out into the open, and it seems they chose to never return to their graves. There's also the story of the schoolteacher who braved the storm on the third floor of the Hutchings Sealy Building. According to Kathleen Shanahan Maka's Ghost of Galveston, the teacher did what others did not dare to. Quote, "As the storm surge rose along the Strand to 17 feet, the people climbed to the top floors. Witnesses from the disaster relate the story that the brave teacher selflessly climbed through a window, balancing on the ledge, and grabbed people as they floated by in the floodwaters, pulling them inside." End quote. Some were alive, some were not. And, according to yesterdaysamerica.com, quote, "She stayed in the building for several days, caring for the sick and injured, until she herself succumbed to the disease epidemic that followed the storm. Today, her ghost is spotted on the staircase of the building, close to where she and the others huddled for safety above the raging storm waters," end quote. She tends to show up, dressed in white, anywhere in the building, with those who work there unsure if it's the schoolteacher or a little boy ghost. The ghost in white leaves handprints on the inside of double-paned elevator glass and is said to be responsible for the occasional minor havoc like moving stuff and blowing out candles. The Tremont Hotel, too, has its fair share of ghosts from the terrible storm of 1900. As reported by GhostCityTours.com, quote, "During storms, televisions turn off and on again, untouched by human hands. Ceiling fans, too, turn themselves on, stirring and spinning around." For Islander magazine, Amy Matsumoto records how one guest witnessed strange lights followed by three low, deep moans in our room very close to our faces, claiming that they felt an unusual pain, like a knife stabbed into my rib cage. The guest had never believed in ghosts, yet one night at the Tremont House Hotel changed everything. End quote. The town rebuilt itself after the awful storm of 1900. With help from all over the country, in 1902, the work of building the city's seawall began, an effort that saw every house and church and store and shop, more than 2,100 of them, raised to 17 feet behind it, a colossal engineering achievement that has rarely been replicated. The storm surge that accompanied a 1915 hurricane that blew through Galveston saw only the loss of 53 lives. But Galveston, it turns out, has more than its fair share of ghosts of souls who died long before or after the storm. It seems to be a super haunted place, if one is inclined to believe such stories. For example, a ghostly face appeared a while back on the outward-facing facade of Ewing Hall, a building owned by the University of Texas Medical Branch. A recent report from TexasHillCountry.com claims, quote, "Over the years, the UTMB Galveston face continues to reappear, despite removal efforts and time. It's even moved positions along the same wall," end quote. It's like a giant stain, think Shroud of Turin-ish, and has withstood sandblasting, harsh chemicals, and a lot of weathering. It just comes back, looking steadfastly at the island. Reporter Athena Hessong wrote in 2017 that the university has decided to leave it the fuck alone because they don't want it to decide to move inside the building. Galveston likes its ghosts. There are tours, of course, which purport to offer glimpses of Lafitte and his crew, other trapped souls, and a few soldiers who lingered after the Civil War. In fact, Galveston is so teeming with ghosts, stranger, that they'll have to wait for another episode. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, deep in Canada's Okanagan Lake lives an ancient beast that long ago was said to keep the people living on the land nearby safe. But over time, that beast became malevolent, and the people living on the land nearby had to keep themselves safe from it. We will meet one of North America's oldest cryptids, Ogopogo. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written by me and Amy Wilson, who also did the research. Editing help from Amber Hunt and sound engineering and mixing by Henry Lavoie. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us on Patreon at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you'll get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why, there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'd wondered if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head over to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download and tell a friend. If you don't like the show, it's free to keep that opinion to yourself. See you next time. Stay strange. Because a lot of ships sunk off Newfoundland. Fuck. Because a lot of ships sunk off Newfoundland. Because a lot of ships sunk off Newfoundland. 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 Because a lot of ships...
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a 1-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.